Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how the Pima County Jail is using a first-of-its-kind program to eliminate opioid deaths.
And Arizona's new Teacher of the Year talks about the lessons he learned during his difficult school years.
But first, there could be a lot of changes on tap within the federal government once President-elect Donald Trump takes office in January. And water officials and experts throughout the Colorado River Basin are thinking about how the new administration may impact their efforts to come to an agreement on a new deal to manage the river and its shrinking water supply. Alex Hager of KUNC has been talking to some of those water officials about this and joins me now to talk about what they had to say. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So what are some of the changes that, in theory, this administration or really any administration could make that would impact or could impact something like Colorado River talks?
The long and the short of it is that Colorado River policy is basically determined by the seven states that use it. Arizona is one of them. And the states put their heads together, come up with new rules for how to share the water, and then turn them over to the federal government. And there's a longstanding historical precedent that the federal government pulls the levers on the dams and manages the nation's big reservoirs. But for the most part, the way that they do that is dictated by the states. So I reached out to a bunch of water policymakers and asked them if they thought a new administration, one that seems poised to be in some ways radically different than, you know, presidents we've had recently, could change that.
And it sounds as like the answer, the short answer is not really.
That is the impression I got. I talked to a number of the top water officials from those seven Western states, including Tom Bouchatsky, who runs the Arizona Department of Water Resources. And they basically said, look, throughout much of recent history, and honestly, a lot of kind of medium to long-term history, water policy and water management have been left to technical experts, and they have not changed that much from administration to administration, regardless of whether a Republican or a Democrat is in the White House. They pointed to the last Trump administration, under which there were significant conservation deals reached, and said even when Trump was doing things that were kind of considered significant shakeups in other areas of national policy, they largely left Colorado River policy more or less unchanged.
I wanted to ask you about the first Trump administration because, yes, you know, there have been Republicans and Democrats doing different things in all sorts of different areas of government. But I think a lot of political experts would say, you know, the first Trump administration was different from even any of those. But it sounds as like even at what you're saying is even during that time, things were pretty much status quo for the folks dealing with this issue.
That is what the state negotiators told me. They said that, you know, I asked them, this upcoming Trump administration has made hints that it might want to gut or entirely dissolve some federal agencies. But the people I talked to said they don't expect those agencies to be the ones that manage Western water. The head water negotiator in Nevada said, you can't necessarily dissolve or gut the agencies that manage Western water because someone still has to be there to manage Lake Powell and Lake Mead. And they seemed to have a lot of confidence that there will not be kind of earth-shattering shakeups to the federal government agencies that manage Western water.
Might there be changes, or did any of the folks with whom you spoke think that there could be changes to sort of the dynamic in terms of the feds asking the states to come up with their agreement and the feds kind of implementing it? Like, might the federal government take a slightly different role here?
That's right. In recent years, as this situation has grown more dire, you know, we have seen the supply for the Colorado River change a lot. Climate change is reducing the amount of water that enters the river and its reservoirs every year. And right now, the big question is on state policymakers to cut back demand in response to that. But right now, they're kind of deadlocked over how to do that. There's a lot of disagreement between the states on how exactly to rein in demand because no one really wants to give up their share.
Yeah.
So I talked to one policy expert, a professor at the University of Nevada, Reno. Her name is Elizabeth Cobley. And she said, look, when there is a lot of discord between the states, it means that federal changes add a little bit of extra risk. In the last few years, we have seen presidential administrations and their water management officials basically say, look, we're going to set deadlines for the states. We are occasionally going to threaten to make changes if they can't do it themselves. And there is some precedent for the federal government making those threats, trying to turn up the heat on the states. And the Trump administration, in a lot of ways, it's pretty unpredictable how they're going to act. And given that there is some precedent for the federal government, you know, trying to hurry this process along, trying to push the states to put their heads together, the Trump administration could do that if there is still disagreement between the states.
Well, and you had reported earlier that the deadline, the federal government will not be, the Biden administration will not be basically signing off on anything before it leaves office. So in large part, this does kind of rest on what the Trump administration wants to do, right?
That's right. So there is confidence that the Trump administration will sign off on whatever the states give to them. But that is because the states kind of missed some soft deadlines to get their agreement in earlier. Right now, the seven states are on the hook to come up with new rules for sharing the river before 2026. The Biden administration said, hey, why wait that long if you can put your heads together and get us a plan before this recent November election? Then we, the Biden administration, can kind of ink all the deals, get the ball rolling on all of the paperwork and all of the lengthy processes we would need to do to get this approved. And the states basically said, yeah, we're going to take our time. They have not made a lot of progress on coming closer to a deal, but they said, we'll get there before 2026, but don't rush us.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Alex Hager of KUNC in Colorado. Alex, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Good to be back. Thanks.
Until this year, people were dying in the Pima County jails at higher rates than the rest of the country. But an innovative opioid treatment program there is changing that. This year, there was a single death in the Pima County jails, a major shift from just the year before. John Washington has been reporting the story for Arizona Luminaria in Tucson, and I spoke with him more about it.
This program began as sort of a pilot in 2015, and at that point, it was addressing only pregnant women who were suffering from opioid addictions. And it's been slowly expanded since then. The biggest expansion came earlier this year in January. And at this point, over a third of everyone who's in the Pima County Jail is receiving what's called medication-assisted treatment, where they're actually getting a form of medication that helps lessen the worst withdrawal symptoms of people who are not getting their standard opioid doses that they were taking on the outside. Mm-hmm. And they also get other forms of help, including some therapy and on their way out of the jail, they get linked up with other service providers in the community, and they get some Narcan and some basic information if they have struggles again on the outside.
Are these always cases that are related to or tied to in some way opioids? Like, does that tend to lead to why these folks are often in jail?
Well, in a lot of cases, yes. This specific treatment only addresses opioids. And a lot of the folks who are in the throes of addiction also are suffering in other ways or are criminalized in other ways because they may be unhoused, they may be committing petty crimes, and it's all wrapped up together. And so, yes, more and more people are either suffering from a mental illness or suffering from a substance use disorder who are in the jail right now.
Yeah. So you're reporting here that this program is not just working. It seems to be working pretty well. You reported there has been a single death in the jail in the last 13 months.
There's been one death in the jail in the last 13 months, which is a steep, precipitous drop from the years that we were seeing before, 2020 through 2022 and 2023. People were dying in the Pima County jail at a high above average rate. And all of a sudden it stopped. There's a number of factors, and this officials say is one of the major ones, that a lot of those deaths were either from drug overdoses, from withdrawal, or suicides. And this addresses all three of those issues, is getting people on medication that really lessens the most severe symptoms of withdrawal and helps them start to cope as they're coming down from opioids.
And just so folks understand, John, describe for us a little bit about what those withdrawal symptoms from opioid addictions can be like. Because if you're arrested, you are suffering from addiction, you are taken away from any access to those drugs, you can go into pretty severe withdrawal pretty quickly.
Yeah, they're really brutal. And One of the other things that the jail has done is they are putting almost everyone who enters into the jail system now into a detox protocol where they are much more strictly monitored than previous. And what it looks like is people having high fevers, people shaking, people vomiting, people really, really struggling, especially in the first few days, if they're not getting their what had become a standard dose of opioids. And it can lead to death and heart failure, and people really, really struggle with it. And so, yeah, this is just trying to get people through, like the drugs that are being administered, trying to get people through those early stages of that really intense withdrawal.
Okay, so talk a little bit about how this program is being funded. It's not cheap, right?
No, it's not cheap at all. It's incredibly expensive. We do not yet know exactly how much it's costing. The medical care that's provided in the jail already costs a lot. It costs the county nearly $20 million a year. So, you know, that's well over $1 million a month. And these new programs are in addition to that. So because of the way that it's contracted and subcontracted, county officials couldn't give me a precise number yet, but that's something we're looking into. But we also know that withdrawals and overdoses cost a lot no matter what. So the price of what the hospitals had to pay for treating overdoses in just 2023 was over a third of $1 billion in Cuba County. It's extraordinarily expensive. It's far higher in Maricopa just because it's such
so
a bigger county.
Yeah.
So people are trying to do a little bit of cost benefit. I mean, of course, you know, you can't really put a price or a value on someone's life or on treating someone, but they recognize that this is going to be expensive either if we treat it beforehand or afterwards. And it just makes a little bit more moral sense to treat it up front.
So there is conversation about continuing this funding and where that money's going to come from going forward, it sounds like.
There is. There seems to be interest. Right now, this money is coming out of the county's general fund. There is also some additional funds coming from some of the opioid settlement funds, and that is mostly directed towards the release planning. So what happens and how people are helped or guided as they're leaving the jail to continue some form of treatment.
Okay. So this comes, John, as there's a broader conversation going on in state government about spending opioid settlement funds at the state level to go to the Department of Corrections. This was a dispute between the Attorney General, Chris Mays, and the governor. And the Attorney General had argued that this was a misuse of these funds. They were meant to curb the opioid crisis, not sort of fund the DOC. Is this showing at least one way maybe in which using these funds in a correctional kind of setting might be productive?
That's what it seems to be. You know, that is a complicated dispute.
Yes.
And there are a lot of factors there. But what we can see in Pima County, I think this holds true for other counties in Arizona, is that a lot of the people who are getting this treatment are receiving it for the first time or the first time in a while. And that's because they just don't have contact with other medical service providers very much on the outside.
Mm.
So when they're in the jail, and this is, officials readily admit, a sorry state of our society, is the only place that they're able to receive quality medical care. And so county officials think, well, they're there, we might as well give it to them. And because they're probably not going to access it in the same way on the outside.
Interesting. John, let me ask you lastly before I let you go. Is this program unique to the Pima County jails? Like, is there anything being done like this elsewhere that you know of?
It is being done elsewhere, but seemingly not to the degree that it's happening in Pima County. Pima County has really been, in a number of different ways, on the forefront of trying to think about healthcare in the jail setting. And as far as we can tell, Pima County is taking a much more aggressive treatment plan than other jails, at least in Arizona and perhaps throughout the country.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. John Washington, investigative journalist for Arizona Luminaria, joining us from Tucson. John, thanks for coming back on. Appreciate it.
Yep. Always glad to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a look back at the heyday of train robberies in the Southwest.
But first, for the first time ever, we have five different generations of workers all at once. As lifespan goes up and costs follow, more workers are delaying retirement as the newest crop, Gen Z, enters the workforce. This has presented new challenges when it comes to intergenerational collaboration and interpersonal relationships in the workplace. This week, we're shining a spotlight on the changes and challenges of this new multigenerational workforce. Yesterday, we took a more philosophical approach to the changes in our feelings about work's place in our lives. Today, we're taking a broad look at how each generation shows up in the workplace and what issues local business leaders are working to solve. The show's Athena Ankara reports.
At work, different age groups have always bumped up against each other. As one generation leaves the workforce to enjoy retirement, another bunch of young up-and-comers launch careers. But lately, we've seen a lot more variation in our workplaces, and the differences have become apparent, especially in our communication styles and expectations. These generational earmarks are not an exact science. Claims about a particular generation's behavior and styles are, for the most part, sweeping generalizations. Still, there are some important takeaways. So, who's all here? The eldest are baby boomers, and even some members of the silent generation before them. According to the Pew Research Center, the number of adults 65 and over who are still working today is almost double what it was 35 years ago. There are several explanations. Jen Ward teaches human resources and employment law at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University.
Particularly in the baby boomer generation, they really developed it was kind of the very like heavy focus on capitalism and success. And it was kind of that Wall Street mentality from the 80s. And I think that a lot of people have a strong tie between their identity and their job. And so it's hard for them to think about retiring because they don't know what else to do. They haven't spent time cultivating other interests. They may have lost touch with their family because they focus so heavily on their jobs during their working years. So now that they're kind of getting to their retirement years, they're not ready to let go. They see that job as tied to their identity and they just want to keep doing it.
Members of Gen X tend to be more informal, growing up as latchkey kids, making for an independent self-starter type. Millennials are our 90s kids. Having entered the job market just as the 2008 recession hit, research shows millennials are a bit less loyal to their employers than previous generations, but inherited their parents' anxiety about work directly reflecting on their value. Finally, there's Gen Z, the most racially and ethnically diverse group of workers and the first generation of so-called digital natives. Many are just starting their careers. They came into the workforce around the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic with a desire for purpose-driven work that meets them as individuals with lives outside of work. And now, members of all of these generations are working together. The age-based divides are becoming more clear with Gen Z's entrance into the workforce, sparking negotiations that we weren't really forced to reckon with before. In addition to teaching classes at ASU, Jen Ward also runs a consulting firm, advising employers. And she says there's one particular debate that's been cropping up a lot since the pandemic, remote work.
Pre-pandemic, there was a huge resistance to it. That's at least what I experienced in the workplace. And there were certain tech companies and things like that where it made sense and they did it. But kind of your everyday company, it just wasn't something that people were really excited to adopt.
It's just one of many conversations presenting themselves in the workplace nowadays. And she says when it comes to different ideas about working from home, the biggest divides fall along generational lines.
Baby boomers have largely been in leadership positions and they are those big proponents of that face-to-face interaction. And the baby boomer generation tends to lean towards what I call command and control leadership, where it's, you know, I'm going to manage you by seeing you. Like, I want to see your body in your chair. And that's how I know that you're getting done what you need to get done. And then COVID hit and almost everyone went remote immediately, and it was a scramble.
Vanessa Bocher is an executive at an international company based in Scottsdale that reviews employee behavior and productivity of other businesses. She says she's seen the remote work issue firsthand at her job, too. Boettcher's in a unique position. She's in charge of fostering collaboration between employees and managers of different age groups.
Definitely hybrid work has been a hot topic for us. Today, we had a very robust conversation about this, where all of these angles play a big role. Some people were sad and saying, no, we have to get back because it's important and it gives us that personal contact and interaction that we need. And then, of course, other people were saying, well, yes, but it you know, some people don't need that. And some people are very productive when they're working on their own.
Ward says the sticking point of the work from home debate comes down to differences in our ideas about work ethic. If you're working remotely, for example, how would employers be sure that everyone's just as engaged as they are in the office?
The technology was there, but the culture was what needed to kind of catch up, and that management style. So figuring out, how do I make sure that people's jobs are getting done, and how can I trust my employees that they are working and they're not shopping, sleeping, watching TV, whatever those worries are that managers tend to have with remote work.
Remote or in person, the question remains, when is it acceptable for workers to sacrifice their personal and family time for the good of the employer, and at what point is the job asking for too much? Boettcher says most of her older colleagues saw things like working extra hours as necessary parts of the job, but even having the flexibility of hybrid schedules as a possibility during the pandemic changed how they thought about it.
Everybody in these past 4 years also has learned the advantage of working from home allows you also to cater to some of your personal needs. So if you have a family, you know, can you go and pick up your kids from school, or can you go and do doctor appointments, or that kind of thing, that is that flexibility of being able to work remotely. And so it was very interesting to see how minds started to change as they were able to hear from each other.
Another key difference in the workplace, especially in white collar settings, is technology. Here's Jen Ward again.
It can be more challenging for especially particularly older people who maybe don't have the experience or the comfort level with technology. It can be hard for young people to deal with that, to like feel like they're having to show somebody who's significantly older than them how to do something when it's a technological thing.
But Boettcher says it's not just the older generations who need to keep up with younger people and new technology. Young people have room for growth, too. And it starts with knowing when to pick up the phone or put tech away entirely when a face-to-face conversation's more appropriate.
Embedded in older cultures, they know they don't have an issue saying, okay, now it's time for me to talk because this is not going anywhere. Where younger people are not necessarily as savvy when it comes to, okay, I probably should do a phone call now because 2 emails after, we're still not getting clarity.
She says today's business leaders have to take in different perspectives, keeping what works and leaving the rest.
That flexible mindset is your winner, because we all have to understand that none of us have the absolute true or the absolute answer. And listening and learning from others is key. We all have something to contribute, but it definitely gets much richer when you listen to what the others have to say.
Success in today's diverse workplace takes a bespoke management approach, where the leader and the team flex to each other's needs. But to develop flexibility, you need mutual respect and understanding. Then, Ward says, this new multi-generational workforce should be an asset, not a problem. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Athena Ankra.
The newly named 2024-2025 Arizona Teacher of the Year almost wasn't a teacher at all. Emmett Burnton is an AP World History teacher at Boulder Creek High School in the Deer Valley Unified School District. And as he told me recently, he was not someone who grew up wanting to be in the classroom.
No, I was pretty mediocre as a student. I think I was suspended in like the 5th grade for fighting.
Oh, wow.
And then that would continue into like the 7th and 8th grade, where I had like conversations with the administrators being like, if you keep acting this way, you will not graduate, type of conversations, where the teachers, they wanted to make that connection. And a lot of them advocated for me. But it's just, you know, when it's like you're speaking on a different wavelength, it's just not quite right.
Yeah.
And then that carried throughout middle school and even throughout high school. Like my 8th grade teacher would write on our report cards, you know, that doesn't happen anymore. But back in the day, they could write maybe like a sentence or two. And mine was always like, does not apply himself. And then even high school, all gen ed, all my siblings were very much studious. They were these students who 4 plus GPA, honors and AP, and I'm just kind of coasting throughout Gen Ed. So in no way did I even like really want to be a teacher as a student.
So what changed then? Because obviously at some point you decided this was something you wanted to do.
Yeah, no, it was a lie. We were in my mom's car and my siblings had asked my twin sister what she wanted to do. And she said journalism and film, because my older brother was journalism. And she kind of got a little bit of flack for it. And so I wanted to go into film, something with film. And I was like, oh gosh, I don't want to get, you know, eviscerated for this. So I just picked a profession that I thought sounded noble, that people would kind of be like, oh yeah, go for it. And they did. They responded exactly as I wanted them to. And then in college, when, you know, now you lied, you have to follow through with it. and then college hit and my professors at NAU, I don't know if it's because my frontal lobe was finally developed or they just said things the right way. But as I was reading in college, or as I was making connections with friends out of the classroom, I was surrounded with just this totally different community who showed me about whether it's like philosophy, the Enlightenment, and things like that. And I had like this epiphany of like agency of like, oh my gosh, like I do matter. Like, you know, kind of like when your teachers are telling you get out and vote and it doesn't really hit for students. That freshman year, it finally did. And I was like, I want to make sure that a student never gets kind of left by the wayside or on this island that I was. And so that pushes me in the classroom like every day to make sure that I can reach those kids and make them have conversations at 16 that I didn't have until I was like 20 or 22 and things like that.
Yeah. So how do you do that? Because obviously it sounds like you had teachers when you were in middle school and high school who were trying to do that for you, mm-hmm. but it wasn't mm-hmm. terribly effective. So maybe what lessons do you take from those and how do you try to maybe adjust them so that you can be effective?
The big thing that I do is I really try and bring it down every single day back to where do I fit into this conversation? When we're talking about, you know, whether it's world history, there's a lot of stuff that the kids don't need to know about as far as like, how does this affect my daily life? But when we're talking about the emperors and the ideas of an exploitative or suppressive power and how you keep the people in line in a social contract, that's something that they can feel every single day, whether a Democrat or Republican student. So I really try and emulate those questions of self-reflection every single day at some point.
When you're trying to have those conversations and think of ways to reach your students and maybe make the material relevant to them, how often do you think back to your school experience and maybe what didn't work?
I'd say I think back pretty frequently, but I think I rely more on my students of what didn't work last year, what didn't work, you know, 2 years before. But yeah, I'd say I reflect almost daily on my past life and how that shaped me. And it made me like reflect on the teachers who I also had, where it's like, yeah, what could they have done differently? Or how could I emulate what they did do and then just modify it a little bit to reach these students?
What is it like to teach social studies right now during, you know, this kind of climate that we're in?
You know, it's something that I think on pen and paper, it's easy to be worried about. But in my classroom, I really try and hit home that being 31, I don't have all the answers. You know, I can't tell these parents, this is what's best for your kids when I don't have kids. You know, we're all trying to come together as a community. And as long as you acknowledge not where I stand, because my students still have like, not bingo cards, but they're trying to figure out, you know, what's my religion? What's my political stance? So instead of telling them what they're supposed to think, really just laying it out of how do people perceive this? Not how it is, but what's the perception of it? That concept or that framing of it makes it a lot more accessible and kind of safer to teach.
Well, it kind of sounds like you're doing for your students what your instructors in college did, where you realize through what they were teaching you that you have agency over your life and sort of the direction it's going to go. It sounds like you are very much trying to make your students understand that they have agency over what they think about things and how they learn about things. And just because something seems a certain way doesn't necessarily mean that is how it is or how it has to be.
Exactly. I think that's like the one thing that I'd want them to take away from my classroom is history. Yes, we study it, but it's also like constantly moving and we are making history. And I know it's easy to hear that as a slogan, but when these students realize how young these revolutionists were, how much power we actually have at local levels, it can kind of click when you have to draw it out for them though, right? We all kind of had that epiphany, but yeah, you're absolutely right. That's like the one thing that I need them, or at least I want them to understand is like they do, it's not just they matter, but they have control over what tomorrow looks like.
What does it mean to you to be the 2024-2025 Arizona Teacher of the Year?
That's a good question. What does it mean to me? There's a lot riding, not necessarily on my shoulders, but there's so many people that I want to bring to light with being the AZ 2024-2025 Teacher of the Year. There are so many people on the stage that night or the candidates who got nominated where it's, I now want to be, whether it's a voice or even a connection to the average person who hears stories like this and the teachers who are in the classroom. You know, sometimes it feels like there's a divide right now when you talk about the climate of what's actually happening in the classroom. And so being the Teacher of the Year is something where it's like, okay, now I have to, I have to be that voice for all of these teachers so we can have an open forum with the rest of the state, you know, where they can understand that we are all doing this for the children.
What do you think your junior high and high school self would think about the fact that you're the Teacher of the Year?
I think they'd wonder who I paid off, probably.
And how much, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because there's like, there's no way we're doing well enough in school now to afford that, but you did it. So yeah, I think honestly, if you had asked me even 48 hours before the awards ceremony or 5 minutes before the announcement, I wouldn't have said I was. So yeah, just in shock. I will say in middle school, I think it was probably my eighth grade year, I started signing people's yearbooks as like, you can sell this when I'm famous. So I think we're a step closer to that now, which is cool. So really, I'm giving back to the community by them being able to sell those yearbooks if Teacher of the Year is a big enough award for that.
All right. Emmett Burton is an AP World History teacher at Boulder Creek High School in the Deer Valley Unified School District, also the 2024-2025 Arizona Teacher of the Year. Emmett, congratulations on the award. Thanks for your time. Thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I hope to talk to you soon.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. The city of Phoenix has allocated a lot of money to plant trees and put in shade structures across the valley. It has an action plan for trees and built shade that represents more than $50 million in public and private investments over the next 5 years. But how much difference can trees make? Well, our next guest has some answers. Peter Ibsen is a research ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, and he was part of a new study that aimed to get some answers here. To do it, he and his team put up sensors all across the valley that measure humidity and temperature, and they did this in 7 other cities around the country. Their measurement? How shade from trees affects temperature. And they found trees can make a whole lot of difference, especially in arid desert cities like ours.
I mean, we have a lot of interest in trying to figure out from the USGS side how different land covers influence temperature, especially during heat waves. But we also want to answer this question of sort of if you expand that to like this nationwide context, how much does the regional climate sort of put its finger on the scale of how much cooling or warming these land covers provide? So that's why we did this across these 8 cities. I mean, it'd be great to do it across more, but we picked these 8. For one reason, they capture a really good gradient of like heat and dryness from Vegas and Phoenix being hot, dry cities to Baltimore, Miami being hot and humid in the summer.
Yeah. And what you found here in comparing the cooling effects of trees in these various cities in these various different climates is kind of hopeful for Phoenix, right? Like, is that the most arid cities like ours saw the biggest cooling effects from trees?
Yeah. I mean, for one, I will say we found cooling effects in all the cities. So even in Baltimore, Miami, in the humid cities, across the board, trees in cities are reducing air temperature on hot days. But yes, in the hottest and driest of cities, that magnitude of cooling increases. So for example, like if we looked at the amount of cooling you're getting from trees in Miami, that could be around, you know, 2.5 to 3 degrees centigrade, whereas in Phoenix, that maximum cooling is up to 4.5 to 5 degrees.
So the dry heat thing that we talk about all the time here really seems to have an effect.
Yeah, we really see that that mechanism, that dry heat is, like if you think of a tree as a living straw.
Sure.
So basically, we see trees as doing, like you said, cooling from 2 main ways, Like they provide shade. We all know that. The USGS is not in the business of just saying it's cooler in the shade. But they also provide cooling through this thing called transpiration, which is very similar to how people sweat. It's water is evaporated from the leaf surface, and that both cools the tree and the leaf, but it also sort of creates this aura of cooling the air temperature around the tree.
Right.
So on very hot, dry days, the tree is very much a mechanistic straw that the dry air is sucking up the moisture from the soil through the tree so it comes out of the leaves.
Huh. And so, that creates a cooling effect. That'll make it feel cooler.
Exactly. Yeah. You get this basically a tree acting as a swamp cooler, or like I have seen in Phoenix on the times I've been there, those little misters that come out on people in restaurants.
We love misters in Phoenix. Yes. Okay.
Yeah, a tree is a giant mister.
So tell us, like, can you tell how far this kind of cooling carries? Like, if there's a tree in my front yard, is it going to cool down the whole area around my house, like people say their lawns do here?
Yeah. So we looked at this, like I mentioned, we put the sensors in the trees, but the way we measured, like, our scale of analysis, to use our like sciencey terms, was to expand this to around 60 square meters around each sensor. So we weren't just basically measuring that effect of the single tree where we put the sensor, but we were measuring the effect of all the land covers surrounding that tree at that sort of like buffer. Uh-huh. So when we're looking at that relationship of tree canopy or grass or buildings or even sidewalks to the air temperature, we're not just talking about that single point, but about all the area within 60 meters surrounding that tree.
But that's a pretty big range. Yeah. Okay. So let me ask you, Peter, about the difference between something like a tree then and this kind of cooling effect you found there and the way it works with the moisture involved and something like a manufactured shade structure, which we also see a lot of in Phoenix. And there's always a debate, it seems, about which might be more effective.
Yeah, that is a fantastic question. And they are both effective. So I like to think of trees are, they are a tool in the toolkit that we use for heat mitigation. They do specific things. So a shade structure, like you mentioned, will do a fantastic job at providing shade. As will a tree with a healthy crown, it provides shade as well. The added bonus that is why we believe at the USGS we're seeing this increase of cooling in these dry cities is that atmospheric pressure that pulls all this water out of the tree. So you're getting the same shade benefits, but you're also getting this, like I mentioned, this wider localized cooling as that water evaporates and just creates this bubble of reduced air temperature surrounding that. So we looked at grass and turf as well.
Right.
And we saw cooling effects around grass and turf. But what we didn't see is that grass and turf had that increase with aridity and dryness and heat.
So let me ask you then lastly, I mean, what do you hope your findings are used for? Like, not just in arid cities like Phoenix and Las Vegas, but in all of these places?
Good question. Because if you're not familiar with the USGS, we are an applied science agency, and we don't want this just to be a academic paper or a scientific paper that is just read by other scientists. We would like this data to be used. So one of the ways that this can be used is, for one, identifying areas to swap out land covers. So we found this cooling effect of trees. We also measured the sidewalks and buildings as well to see how much they warm. Mm-hmm. So you could think of this not necessarily as being used as, well, if we add this many trees, we get this much cooling. You could use these results to also do the math to calculate, well, if we remove this much impervious surface or this much pavement and add this many trees, then we actually get the reduction of warming from the surfaces plus that addition of cooling from trees. One other important thing to mention, though, and this is important for Phoenix and Las Vegas, this is all very water dependent. So we really want people to know that if you want this type of cooling, if cities and managers and planners are aiming to plant trees, these added benefits we see in the desert cities, we really see that coming because of that access to water. So any of these trees, they need to be irrigated and have enough soil moisture to provide that sort of sweating transpirational benefit that we see in the ones that we've measured.
All right, we'll leave it there. Peter Ibsen, research ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey at the Geoscience and Environmental Change Center, joining us to talk about this study. Peter, thanks so much. This is useful.
Thank you so much for calling. I love to talk about this work.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Back in October, the Arizona Republic reported on what may be the first train robbery in more than 100 years. The incident hardly had the makings of a Hollywood Western. The perpetrators were caught and arrested after a low-speed chase. But back in what you might call the glory days of train robberies, the Southwest, and Cochise County in particular, was home to roving bands of notorious railroad thieves. Around the turn of the 20th century, outlaws began to see the railroad as a fast track to big score. Doug Hocking is the author of Southwest Train Robberies, and he estimates that there were 16 major rail heists between the laying of the tracks in the 1880s and the end of the train robbing era in the 1920s. Back then, Hocking told the show's Sam Dingman, trains were vulnerable because of the way they were laid out.
Which was locomotive, and then the baggage express mail car, which were often the same car. Behind that, the smoking car, if any, followed by passenger cars, and finally by the Pullman cars. And why did they organize that way? Well, to keep the smoke away from the passengers.
Right. So you wanted to have as much distance as possible between the cars where there were going to be passengers riding and the locomotive. But of course, that means that you're filling that distance with the cars containing all the valuable stuff.
Right. Now, the express car would have two kinds of wealth.
Express here refers to, like, the mail, right?
Yeah, express refers to the mail, but it also refers to what they call express matter, which is typically high-value items. Money was in the through safe to which the express agent did not have the key.
So if in this safe there was nobody on board with a key, how did the burglars get into it?
You blew the safe.
I was guessing that might be the answer.
On the Wilcox Playa in 1895, a couple of the boys took the express car, and they blew the safe open, and they blew express car and pesos all over the playa. We're still finding the pesos.
Sounds like that'd be a good road trip for me to take. Go down there and see if I can find some pesos.
Yeah, why not?
So, from the way you're describing it, this seems like an incredibly high-stakes, high-risk type of burglary to try to pull off, to try to presumably, what, ride up alongside this train on a horse, jump on to this particular car where the valuables are kept. You're carrying, what, dynamite, some type of explosive, and you have to get in, subdue the folks who are in there, and then pull off this explosion and get out again before the train goes off the rails? I mean, this sounds like a very intense crime.
Well, let's consider something that was done three times. Steen's Pass, which you may have noticed on I-10. It's 3 miles inside New Mexico. And three times the train was robbed there. And basically, the guys would walk up to the locomotive, tell the engineer, disconnect the passenger cars, take this train to Cochise County. 3 miles later, you're over the line into Cochise County. The nearest law is in Tombstone, 100 miles away. And who have you got to deal with? The express agent, the engineer, and the fireman. You know, in that sense, it's fairly safe. A lot of times they were after payrolls.
Yeah, this is fascinating. You know, it's just occurring to me in this moment that we're talking about a time before direct deposit. So for the money to pay workers to make it to those workers, they had to send them the literal cash on a train.
Exactly. And there were tricks. You never knew which day it was coming on. They'd send it early and then pack it in with groceries just to fool outlaw attempts.
That's so interesting to think about that being a time when if you're the worker who is expecting that payout, you, if I'm hearing you right, probably had to adjust to the fact that payday was sort of a moving target because of the clear and present danger of train robberies.
Well, you know, once they had it on site, they'd lock it in somebody's safe and nobody knew it was there.
Hearing you tell these stories, I'm struck by the time in which all of this was happening, because here we have these, I have to say, very innovative criminals who are taking advantage of the fact that the American West was kind of being invented at the same time as they were inventing these ways of profiting off of the development of the American West. And the railroad was such a potent symbol of that invention because it so supercharged our ability to move people and cash and assets over these long distances. It makes me think of one of my favorite quotes from your book, which is, there is something about this corner of Arizona that attracts and inspires bad men. So would you say that trains were just more fodder for pre-existing bad men, or did the trains help create the bad men?
We had an extremely rough element down here already. It's a population that came up from Texas. A lot of them already in trouble down there. They got to Cochise County, which is where they split up the herds that were going to the military and the reservations. And once the guys were paid off, they'd spend their money on wine, women, song, gambling, completely waste the rest of it. And now destitute, they had no way to get back to Texas. So they went on to doing what they had always done best, herding other people's cows, this time without permission. And when that became less profitable, there were stagecoaches and then railroads.
Right. So really, it was just that the prospective target of what they were already doing just got more and more valuable.
More valuable, yeah, and a bit more sophisticated. In the book, I covered primarily armed robberies. I didn't cover breaking and entering. I had an argument with the people of Benson who sincerely wanted to have a train robbery. They said 1942, they had the last one. There was a boxcar parked on a siding and somebody broke in and stole three cases of Spam. You go, Benson, that's not a train robbery. I got one for you. Maricopa County Sheriff, 1910. And now I may need my wife's help from the other room. He's got a building at ASU named after him.
Hayden.
Carl Hayden. 1910, he was sheriff of Maricopa County. Carl had train robbers, the Beardless Boys. He pursued them in a Stoddard Dayton touring car, value at the time about $3,500, which is like saying he borrowed a Maserati and went crashing across trackless desert, stopping every few miles to fix flats and repair the car in pursuit of outlaws. It's the first automotive pursuit. And the big change here is we've got telegraph all along the rail line. We're starting to get roads. We've got automobiles, and pursuing the armed robbers becomes much easier at the same time that shipments of specie are diminishing on the rail line.
I see. So that's the other factor behind the reduction in train robberies. It's not just that they started finding other ways of shipping valuable things. It's that the ability of the folks who owned the rail lines to do more than just pick random days to send the payroll got a little bit more sophisticated too.
Exactly.
Well, Doug Hocking is the author of Southwest Train Robberies. Thank you so much, Doug. This is such a fascinating window into such a pivotal time in Arizona history and American history.
Sam, it's been fun talking to you.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.